Tonight, a CBS special movie presentation. Before he was New York's top cop in the new hit drama Blue Bloods, Tom Selleck was Chief Jesse Stone.
I noticed you're carrying.
That's good police work, Chief.
Now he's back in Paradise.
Paradise Police Department.
I'd like to report a shooting.
You need to be careful.
In an all-new world premiere movie event.
Don't be cute.
It's hard for me not to be cute.
Jesse Stone, Innocence Lost. Next, only CBS.
You are listening to video description on the SAP channel. This service is primarily intended for viewers who are blind or visually impaired. To return to regular program audio, turn off the SAP feature on your TV or VCR. Credits appear. Tom Selleck as Robert B. Parker's Jesse Stone, Innocence Lost, Kathy Baker. A horse-drawn wagon travels through the quaint town of Paradise, Massachusetts. Cole Suddeth. Red Boathouse is Lina Marina. Gloria Rubin. An old man with a walking stick ambles down a slanted sidewalk past a building's front door. Stephen McHattie, William Sadler. A lighthouse stands at the foot of a hill. Mark Blum. A lone buoy floats in the bay. Eileen Boylan. Beyond a grassy field, a jogger in gray sweats crosses a long wood plank bridge. Mike Irwin. Jeff Geddes. Ray Ritke. Carrie Smith. Valov Charoff. Stacy Smith. Under an expansive, overcast sky, a distant peninsula juts into the bay. The jogger runs along the shore with Saul Rubinek and William Devane. As the jogger heads through some woods, his running shoes fall hard on a gravel path. Music by Jeff Beal, edited by Stephen Cohen, ACE. Beyond a rusted anchor, a short dock extends from a baby blue boathouse. Production designer David Chapman. Director of photography David Gribble, ACS. Dark clouds move across the sky, obscuring the sun. Produced by Stephen Brandman. Raindrops pierce the water's surface around reeds and lily pads. Executive producer Michael Brandman. A caterpillar clings to a chewed leaf. Water drips off of a tree's bark. Rain falls hard on tall grass. Executive producer Tom Selleck. The jogger continues along the rocky coast, passing a single diminutive evergreen. We watch from behind a dilapidated blue rowboat on the shore as he runs by in the background. Based upon characters created in Robert B. Parker's Jesse Stone books, on a winding road, the jogger walks with his hands in the pockets of his hooded sweatshirt. Written by Tom Selleck and Michael Brandman, a black SUV rounds a bend in the wet road. Directed by Dick Lowry, this program has been described by the Media Access Group at WGBH with funding from CBS. Described by Michael Longarzo, Kate O'Toole, Anna Capizera, and Rebecca Peterson. Read by Gailey Heidemann. As the jogger ambles along the road shoulder, the SUV approaches him from behind. He lifts his hooded head to reveal his salt and pepper goatee and disgruntled expression. Jesse ambles to a halt and the black SUV stops alongside him. As he faces the vehicle, the tinted driver's side window lowers to reveal another middle-aged man with a thin, hardened face, Captain Healy.
I'm working on the new me.
I was on my way home, thought I'd stop by you, boys. See how you're doing.
Jesse takes off his cap and scratches his head.
So, how you doing?
I hate jogging.
Your dog wouldn't let me cross the bridge.
Apparently he's not a jogger.
And you are?
I was, for a while.
Can you come into Boston tomorrow?
Pretty busy. I'll check my schedule.
See if you can squeeze it in.
How about a ride?
It's unlocked.
Jesse walks around the front of the SUV and opens the passenger door. He gets inside. A distant view of the coast shows the SUV driving off. Now a line of mature evergreens stands tall across the inlet as Jesse walks across the old wood plank bridge toward his home. Just atop the incline sits Reggie, his golden retriever. The dog's shaggy coat flutters in the breeze. As Jesse gently purses his lips, Reggie twitches his snout. Jesse walks past him and the dog follows his master to the other side of the bridge. A lone fishing boat with a blue hull floats in the water beyond. Jesse and Reggie head for their red house, which stands behind a lone spruce on the bank. Nighttime. As rain falls outside a window, Jesse watches a small television in his bedroom. In the climactic scene from the bridge on the River Kwai, William Holden crawls up to Alec Guinness.
You.
Reggie attentively watches the screen. Jesse sips a drink. On screen, Alec Guinness holds his officer's cap behind his head.
What have I done?
Jesse purses his lips. Alec Guinness dives from a mortar blast on River Sandy Beach. Reggie continues to watch as the character gets back up, wipes his hat on his pant leg, and eyes a plunger on a detonator. He drops his hat and staggers. A Japanese locomotive approaches the wooden bridge. The character's eyes roll back and he falls dead, landing on the plunger. The center of the bridge explodes. Reggie looks on as the train plunges off the collapsed bridge. With a blank expression, Jesse watches the last of the cars fall into the river. Smoke rises from the wreck. The sullen ex-police chief raises his drink to his lips and takes a slow sip. He looks at the dog, who appears to frown back at him. Jesse lowers his drink, keeping his eyes fixed on the canine. He holds his left palm over the space next to him and pats the mattress. Reggie remains seated, holding his gaze on his master, then settles into his plush green dog bed and rests his head on his paws. Jesse turns his eyes to the television to find James Donald's pained expression.
Madness.
He reaches to a nightstand and picks up a remote control, then eyes the television again. James Donald grimaces.
Madness.
Cut to black. The next morning, near the Paradise Cove Pavilion, Jesse stands with his hands in his jacket pockets. Reggie sits facing him. Eyeing his pet with a somber gaze, Jesse gives a soft nod. The dog's ears perk up and he runs off. Jesse shifts his stance and sighs. Watching his dog race down the beach towards a yellow-sided vessel, he purses his lips. Reggie digs up a stick from the sand, frolics in a wide circle, and stares back at his master. Wagging his tail, the dog chews the stick, then drops it on the ground. Jesse lowers his gaze. A police cruiser rounds a bend, passing a parked table on a patch of grass. Jesse notices and turns to face the vehicle. Rose gets out from the passenger side with a tray of coffees. Suitcase steps out from behind the wheel with a box of donuts. They join Jesse at a wooden table under the gazebo.
Why so early? Nobody's on the clock till 8.
Exactly. Donuts, they're...
Copley?
The three sit down together. Suitcase and Rose swap an anxious look.
So what are you going to do, Jesse?
I'm going to mull.
Mulling's good.
He nods and swaps another look with Rose.
Today's your last day, Suit.
New chief starts tomorrow.
How do you feel about that?
How I feel about that? I don't know how I feel about that, Lou.
He's Jesse.
I know that.
He opens the box of donuts.
Oh, what the hell?
Jesse takes one.
I'm working on the new me.
Rose gives him a concerned look.
So what are you gonna do?
After I mull, I'm gonna do some jogging.
You know what I mean, Jesse.
He smiles sadly, then looks at Suitcase, who averts his gaze while eating a donut. Now in the psychiatrist's office, Reggie lies on the couch while the doctor pours coffee.
I thought he should hear this.
He's a dog.
If you say so. I'm gonna have to run a tab for a while, that okay?
For a while?
Most golden retrievers live for affection. He never seems to want any. I think he has issues.
What issues?
My issues.
Fear of loss?
When I met him, he was sitting next to his owner's body.
Existential despair.
Seated across from the desk, Jesse sips his coffee.
This was a stupid idea.
How are you dealing with it?
Well, we're kind of like roommates.
The loss.
What loss?
The job.
I'm jogging.
Jogging clears your mind?
I hate jogging.
Why bother?
It clears my mind.
Have you talked to your ex-wife?
No.
Have you wanted to talk to Jen?
Yes.
But you have not talked to her?
That's correct.
Last time you said you can't call her.
No. I said she can't call me.
Why can't she call you?
I ripped the phone out of the wall.
You had a fight?
No, I picked a fight 3 weeks ago.
You were angry.
No. Frightened.
Why is this so hard?
He takes a seat.
I'm in a dead zone.
It's not the first time you felt this way.
No, I can't get cell phone reception in my house. I gotta go outside to the point.
Keep a bottle of scotch out there?
That's not funny.
I didn't mean it to be.
I'm not that far gone.
If you say so. You lost your job in L.A. Now you've lost your job in paradise. Are you drinking?
I always drink.
Are you drinking a lot?
I'm sticking to my rule.
Two drinks a night.
That's correct.
Are two drinks a night a lot?
No.
Then you're not drinking a lot.
I'm having two drinks at night.
You're having two drinks at night alone.
Now our view drifts from the red brick facade of the Paradise Police headquarters to Suitcase, who peers outside through window blinds. He stands alone in the chief's office with his arms folded. Rose sits at her desk talking on the phone.
Did you tell me this morning you're jogging?
I did.
You hate jogging.
I was wondering if you could feed Reggie for me tonight.
I can. Oh, I gotta go.
She hangs up.
Rose, I'd like you to meet your new chief, William Butler.
Actually, we've met already.
The job interview. Based on ex-Chief Stone's attitude, I bet you never thought I'd be standing here.
Well...
It's funny how things work out, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Councilman Hansen, I heard your daughter was in the hospital. How's she doing?
Oh, she's fine.
It's just an appendectomy.
William, I wish you wouldn't do that.
Do what?
Finish my sentences.
I'm sorry, sir.
She'll be fine.
Is the temp chief in?
He is.
Could I see him?
We don't stand on ceremony here. Go right on in.
Well, I don't want to meddle in police business. See you at dinner, William.
Councilman Hansen leaves. Butler enters the office.
Information's out there. All you have to do is let it in, Rose.
William.
Suitcase notices the brown-haired man.
Sorry. I wasn't expecting you.
Until tomorrow. I thought it would be better. Well, maybe a little less embarrassing for you if you could move back to your old desk today.
I guess it might be awkward.
Suitcase nods. Rose peeks in from her desk. Suitcase sits behind the chief's desk and folds his hands.
How's your wife doing? Small town.
It's just an
appendectomy.
She'll be fine. The badge.
Excuse me?
The chief's badge. May I have it?
Suitcase opens a drawer and takes out the gold shield.
This is Lou Carson's badge. Jesse wouldn't carry it.
Well, I'm sure you're very busy. Good work solving that convenience store robbery, Detective Simpson.
He waves the badge and exits.
We don't have detectives.
Detective Gammon?
We don't have detectives.
As a troubled Rose watches him leave, the image dissolves to a gloomy, cloud-filled sky. On a country road, a police car heads past a white church with a tall spire. As Rose drives, raindrops begin to fall on her windshield, and she turns on the wipers. Her cruiser heads down the one-lane road past red-leafed shrubbery growing among the wild foliage. As the cruiser passes an inlet, Rose notices something on the road ahead. Through her windshield, she sees a white SUV parked at an odd angle on the road's right shoulder. The police car pulls over for a second behind the lone vehicle, which bears a Massachusetts license plate. Rose pulls up to the driver's door and sees the head of a brunette girl leaning motionless against the window. The officer lowers her passenger window, gaping at the sight. Rose flips open her cell phone, presses a button, and holds it to her ear.
Good afternoon, Paradise Police Department.
Luther, I'm on the beach road going out to Jesse's. Can you get out here right away?
I can.
Bring Doc Perkins.
Her gaze fixed on the girl, Rose lowers her cell phone. Now she stands near Jesse's house, patting Reggie's head. The ex-police chief crosses the bridge in jogging clothes. In the distance, a gray boathouse sits nestled at the water's edge. Jesse walks up a mild slope past the lone spruce tree.
You don't have to take him over to your house. Just feed him here. What's wrong?
Cindy Van Alden is dead.
Later inside, he picks up a stack of mail and goes through the letters with trembling fingers.
Who found her?
I did.
He looks at her.
I found her on the beach road about a mile from here. Was she coming to see you, Jesse?
He pulls out a letter, tosses the rest of the stack on a side table, and hands it to Rose.
I got that from her 2 days ago.
You didn't open it.
I got preoccupied. Read it if you want.
He sits on the arm of a leather chair. Rose removes a page from the envelope and unfolds it.
Read it out loud.
They share a glance, then she reads the letter.
Jesse, I'm sorry I haven't stayed in touch. You are my best friend. I need to talk. I tried to call you, but your phone is disconnected. I'm coming back to paradise. Cindy.
Jesse stares at the floor. Rose hands him the letter.
Doc Perkins said it looks like a drug overdose.
Did he say anything else?
He said she just stopped breathing.
When's toxicology come back?
Jesse, you're not the police chief anymore.
He hangs his head with an anguished expression. Observing him, Rose momentarily lowers her gaze.
Have dinner with me.
You want me to have dinner with you tonight?
I do.
We'll watch your boys.
It's Jim's night with the boys.
You don't want me to be alone?
That's correct.
Jesse glances at the letter, then sadly gazes at Rose. The image dissolves to rainfall over the darkened rocky shoreline. In Jesse's living room, Reggie lies on his brown leather chair. He lifts his head, listening. Jesse unlocks the door and enters. Reggie puts his head back down. The ex-chief hangs his jacket on a hook beside his PPD hat, then enters the kitchen. He places his handgun and a glass on the counter, then pours himself a drink from a half-empty bottle of scotch. As he takes a long sip, he notices the dog staring at him.
What are you looking at?
Reggie continues to hold his gaze. Later, Jesse twists a metallic knob and a needle lowers to a spinning record. Jesse sits in his chair and tilts his head back. Our view floats toward him through a hallway with dark wood paneling. Jesse remains frozen, seated in the center of his dim, rustic living room. His lips part and he lifts his head. He leans forward, rests his elbows on his knees, and takes a sip of his drink. He picks up his cell phone from a side table, checks the front display, then sets it back down. Noticing the letter from Cindy on the coffee table, he picks it up. As he reads the blue ink handwriting, he raises his glass to his lips for another sip of scotch. Reggie eyes him from the other chair. Now outside in the pouring rain, the wet dog sits beside his master. Jesse takes out his cell phone, flips it open, and dials a number. To his right, the darkened, jagged shoreline disappears into the horizon. Jesse puts the phone to his ear.
Hello? Jesse.
He lowers the phone. Reggie peers at him through the rain, water dripping from his soggy golden coat. Jesse hunches his shoulders and swallows. Now in his bedroom, our view lowers from a rain-pelted window to the golden retriever lying on his dog bed. Noticing Jesse's bed empty and unmade, Reggie sits up and looks over the rumpled covers. The dog walks over a throw rug at the foot of the bed and crosses to the door. In the living room, the needle scratches along the center of the spinning record. Our view drifts past the idle television set to the coffee table, which holds a book, the empty scotch bottle, and Jesse's firearm. A lamp remains lit on the table between the two leather chairs. Jesse sleeps on his side against his armrest. The dog enters the hallway and stops short upon seeing his master. Jesse's bare feet dangle off the chair. Reggie sits with his tongue hanging from his open mouth. As Jesse breathes, his rib cage rises and falls languidly. The dog remains seated down the hall at the end of a long throw rug. Daytime. Jesse crosses his psychiatrist's office and sits before the desk.
Where's Reggie?
Home.
I had to cancel an appointment.
Thank you.
So, I've canceled my appointment. What's so urgent?
You said I had a fear of loss.
No, you said that.
No, last time you said I had a fear of loss.
Because the time before you told me you did.
Jesse jots on a notepad.
Why is this so hard?
He rips the page out.
I hate cell phones. I don't want anyone else to have that number.
He gives it to a psychiatrist.
I called Jen.
You told me you haven't spoken to her.
I hung up.
So you haven't spoken to Jen in 3 weeks?
That's correct. Tell me about addiction.
What about it?
Drugs.
This is not about you.
How do you know?
Because I know a lot about addiction. You're not a candidate for pills. Booze is your drug of choice. Did you come here for help or did you come here for information?
I came here for help and information. I busted this kid a couple of years ago.
For using drugs?
Drunk and disorderly. Her mom's very well off, one of those big houses out in Paradise Point. Divorced, an ugly one. Mom wanted to take her home. I insisted she spend the night in Paradise Jail.
That sounds like you.
Talked to her most of the night. Good kid, Mr. Dad. I said that I was her friend and that I'd keep in touch.
That sounds like you.
Mom put her in rehab, one of those expensive places in Boston. When she got out, she went back to college.
And you kept in touch?
I did. For a while.
What happened?
She's dead.
Drugs?
Most likely.
Did they give her prescription drugs when she left rehab?
I have no idea.
When I asked you what happened, I meant why did you lose contact with her?
I guess I got preoccupied. That's my favorite subject.
What subject's that?
Me.
Did I ever tell you have a hyperactive sense of responsibility?
You did.
Well, let's recap. You live where no one can find you. You drink alone. You've talked to your ex-wife every day since your divorce. You've cut yourself off from her for 3 weeks. And now you feel responsible for this kid's death.
That's about it.
Before you came here yesterday, I hadn't seen you in a month.
3 weeks.
We need to spend more time together. Once a month is not enough.
If you say so.
The gray-bearded psychiatrist eyes him plainly. Jesse gazes off and wrinkles his face.
I got wasted last night.
Okay. And that's why you called me.
That's correct.
On the verge of tears, Jesse shares a long gaze with the blue-eyed doctor. The image freezes and fades out.
If you need me, I'll be at the speed trap, sir.
I think it would be more appropriate not to refer to the entrance to paradise as the speed trap.
I understand, sir.
You don't have to call me, sir. Did you get the medical examiner's report, Luther?
Sir, that won't come in until toxicology is finalized. Doc Perkins' preliminary findings show no sign of foul play. Drug overdose is most likely the
cause of death. Good. I'm sorry, I didn't mean it that way. It's a horrible tragedy, but at least there's no indication of a crime.
Suicide's a crime?
Only technically. What I meant was lots of kids OD. But crime is bad for tourism, and tourism is Paradise's main business.
I know that, sir.
We may have gotten lucky here. It didn't make this morning's paper. And I think we can get the town council to exert some influence over at the Gazette. Headline it something like, Boston college student found dead of drug overdose on Beach Road.
But she lives here.
No, her mom lives here. She lived at school in Boston. What do you think, Luther?
My sense is we need to tell the truth, sir.
That is the truth.
His gaze hardening into a dissatisfied scowl, Suitcase leaves the police chief's office. Now Jesse walks down a sidewalk, a cup of coffee in hand. He digs his cell phone from his jacket pocket, eyes the display, and answers.
Thanks for dinner.
Are you okay?
I'm fine. Is he there?
He is.
How do you feel about that?
How do I feel about that?
Gotta go.
He flips the phone shut and reaches a used car lot. Inside, a curvaceous woman with cocoa skin and raven curls files paperwork.
Thelma.
Jesse.
She gestures politely to a chair.
Can I help you, Jesse?
They sit facing each other.
Your hair smells of violets.
You know what violets smell like?
No, but I'm sure violets would smell that way if I'd ever smelled a violet.
I don't mean this in any negative way, but you may be the simplest person I've ever met.
In what way?
You know what you want?
Sometimes I know what I want.
You know what you want right now?
I do.
Are you going to tell me?
I can't tell you.
You know what you want, but you can't tell me.
I don't want to presume.
I see.
I can tell you what I'm hoping.
Tell me what you're hoping.
I'm hoping I can see you sometime.
You mean you're hoping that you can see me again?
Sorry to keep you waiting, Jesse.
Jesse stares at Thelma.
I came early.
She coyly cocks her head. Standing, Jesse joins Hasty in an office set up with a pinball machine.
Mrs. Gleffy's a hottie.
Hadn't noticed. So you're done with your ex-wife?
I didn't say that. I'm obsessed with Thelma, but...
He sits.
I'm in love with Sissy.
Have you talked to her since she moved to Boston?
How would you know she moved to Boston?
A small town.
You and Sissy...
Me and Sissy what, Hasty?
The stout man gives a rueful little nod.
She won't return my calls.
Nice.
Well, I just closed on a slightly used Beamer M6 Minty.
His bow tie lights up.
Can you imagine?
Who's the lucky guy, Hasty?
Don't ask.
Could you turn that thing off?
I can.
Hasty takes out a switch wired to the tie and turns it off. Jesse takes a seat facing him.
So, how's the drinking thing going?
I'm very fond of you, Jesse.
I know that, Hasty.
Can I tell you something?
Do I have a choice?
I'm running for town council.
Hasty, you're a felon.
So is Marion Barry. I got one word for you, Jesse. Redemption.
You going to church?
No, it's my platform. Redemption. I'm sorry. This shouldn't just be about me. Don't you think I've got a winner? Redemption. It's just one word. It's easy to get emotionally. It kind of punches you in the gut.
I don't like the train. Lets me think too much.
Excuse me?
You know that car you let me drive?
Test drive.
Can I drive it to Boston?
You already test drove it.
Perhaps you could consider it a loaner.
That would imply that you got a car in here for repair.
Yeah, my Scout you're repairing.
Your Scout's beyond repair. It's a rusted hulk.
Exactly.
Now in a jail cell.
But I don't know what that's supposed to mean. You're saying I have issues?
You do.
How would you know that?
I'm the police chief. I know everything.
So I have to spend the night in jail?
We both do.
What is that supposed to mean?
If you spend a night in jail, I can't go home.
You can't put me in jail just because you think that I have issues.
No, I can't.
And my mom wanted me out of here.
She did.
So then why can't I go home?
Public drunkenness is illegal.
This is not right!
I'm not in the right and wrong business. I'm in the legal and illegal business.
You don't make any sense.
The image starts breaking up. Now in traffic, Jesse slams on his brakes, stopping within an inch of the car in front of him. He heaves a shaky sigh. Ahead, illuminated arrows flash, separating drivers into divergent lanes, while hulking red construction machines block the street. A backhoe crosses the road, and a worker waves traffic through. As he beckons Jesse onward, the troubled ex-cop stares off, his gaze distant and troubled. He glances distractedly at his rearview mirror, then drives on alongside a concrete and steel bridge that towers over the road. At the police station, Butler approaches Rose.
Detective Gammon, can I talk to you for a moment?
We don't have detectives, sir.
Well, what should I call you?
Rose.
Well, Rose, as you know, we're understaffed here. We lost a very good man when Detective D'Angelo left. I'm sorry, how do we refer to our personnel?
As officers, sir. Chief Stone had a problem in that...
He didn't like Officer D'Angelo.
That isn't what I was going to say, sir.
You don't have to call me Sir Rose.
What should I call you?
I don't know. How about Chief?
Well, Chief, the former chief felt that Officer D'Angelo spent too much time writing tickets.
That's a good thing. Tickets bring in...
A lot of revenue.
Anyway, being shorthanded, I'm going to need you here manning your desk. This has nothing to do with you being a woman. I want you to know that, Rose.
You need someone to man the telephones to be a kind of dispatcher.
I prefer that you think of it more as a temporary kind of home guard action.
Then I'll try to think of it that way.
Thank you, Rose.
With a satisfied nod, he returns to his office. Rose stands motionless, staring after him. Her head droops forward and she shifts her unhappy gaze. Facing the coffee maker, she shakily pours herself a cup. Meanwhile, in Healy's office at Boston State Homicide, Jesse does the same. The captain enters from the busy bullpen and joins him.
Thank you.
He takes the steaming cup.
I guess it takes me 24 hours to get offended. You could have called.
Frowning, Jesse pours himself another cup.
I'm in a dead zone. Okay. Truth is, I forgot. By the time I thought to call you, it was raining again. Was it important? I don't know. I got a perp on trial for robbery and murder. What's your problem?
Healy adds creamer to his coffee.
What makes you think I got a problem? Every time you stop by to see how I'm doing, either you got a problem or I got a problem. Well, you got a problem. So do you. How do you know? Copley intuition.
Jesse dryly sips his coffee. The police captain shuts the office door, then faces him with a furrowed brow.
I don't think the perp's the perp. Excuse me? I don't think he did it. Did what? Robbed a liquor store, got the money, shot the owner in the face 3 times. Nice. Your bust? No, one of my ambitious college students. Case is a slam dunk. Eyewitness ID, credit card receipts, cell phone records. Put them in the area at the right time. Final argument set today. And you got a problem? I do. Why do you have a problem? Copley intuition. If I set it up, will you talk to him? I will. Just one thing. This time, I want to be deputized. You want to be a consultant who's deputized? Might be nice to carry a badge again.
Jesse lowers his vulnerable gaze, and Healy regards him shrewdly. Now a polished floor reflects Jesse as he arrives at the top of a stairway. Silhouetted against large paned windows behind him, he strides purposefully down a corridor. Later, in an administration office, a prim woman with a blonde updo meets him at a counter with a file.
And your name again?
Jesse. And yours?
You sure this is police business?
Yes, ma'am.
He shows a badge.
State homicide.
Because Rutherford College doesn't reveal this kind of information, not even to family.
What if the parents are paying the bills?
The privacy and integrity of Rutherford students is paramount. But since you're with the government, what would you like to know?
I see that.
I don't think so.
She draws the file close to her chest.
What would you like to know?
How is Cindy doing?
Cynthia was unfortunately showing a downward trend in achievement over the last year. And of course, she dropped out of school in the middle of last quarter.
Could you be mistaken?
I don't think so.
Was anyone informed?
There's no need. Her tuition was paid for in advance, and it's not refundable. Why do you want to know?
She's dead.
The administrator stares wide-eyed, and her expression softens.
Do you have any other questions?
I don't think so.
He turns away and leaves. As the administrator gazes after him, the image freezes. Now Paradise's colorful buildings dot the waterside hills beneath an overcast sky. At the wheel of his loaner SUV, Jesse sips from a stainless steel insulated mug. Craning his neck forward, he peers up with a lifted brow. Tall, lush trees line the upper-class residential street. Jesse pulls into a turnabout driveway in front of an expansive Victorian-style house painted slate blue. He parks behind a black luxury sedan and gets out. Now from inside, we watch Jesse through a single-pane window as he arrives at the door. Gazing in, he stuffs his hands in his jacket pockets. An elegant woman in a simple gray dress comes out to greet him.
Chief Stone.
Jesse would be better.
I heard. Small town. Did I miss your call?
I didn't call.
This would be about Cynthia. Come in.
She steps aside and he enters. Now steaming coffee pours from a white porcelain pot into a matching cup on a saucer. Standing at a kitchen island, a maid hands the coffee to Jesse. Cindy's mother stands at a window.
For a mother, the loss of a child is so unfair.
The maid steps away.
I'm sorry I didn't call. I got preoccupied.
Chief Butler mentioned the possibility of suicide.
Cindy didn't commit suicide.
How do you know?
I just know.
You're not chief of police anymore, Jesse.
Old Hammett.
You were friends.
We were friends. There's just some things I should know about Cindy that I don't. What happened with college?
Nothing happened with college. After rehab, she went back to school.
What about last quarter?
She seemed fine. She was very involved in school. She'd even met someone.
Did you meet him?
No.
Do you remember his name?
Of course I remember his name. Cynthia met him in rehab. His name was Val.
Do you know his last name?
No. I know you don't think much of me as a parent.
I didn't say that.
Have you talked to Cindy's father?
I haven't talked to him since the custody hearing.
Has Cindy?
I should hope not.
Does he know?
I assume so. He's living in Singapore.
Had you talked to Cindy recently?
Had you?
Now in an interrogation room, a chubby man in a cheap suit faces Jesse, who sits at a long table reading his notepad.
You're the guys who put him away. So why should we talk to someone from state homicide?
You don't have to.
Well, we always want to explore all our options, but my client's not going to be convicted. We presented a very strong defense.
Not that strong if you're talking to me.
The young defendant tensely eyes his lawyer.
I've been looking over the cross-exam. I have some questions.
He reads his notes.
Prosecutor, we have you at the crime scene. Charles Morris, I wasn't there. Prosecutor, if you can prove you were somewhere else, speak up. Public defender, objection.
He faces the lawyer.
Objection. If the prosecutor is stupid enough to help establish an alibi, why wouldn't you let him?
Are you trying to tell me how to do my job?
No. I'm asking a question. Your client's going to get convicted, and he's going to get sentenced to the maximum. If you can cast reasonable doubt as to his whereabouts, why wouldn't you let him speak?
Jesse eyes the clean-cut young defendant.
Can you talk?
I'm sorry.
Please address your questions.
Officer Stone.
He gives his lawyer a firm look. The public defender gestures permissively.
Jesse.
Jesse, I can't prove that I was somewhere else. Can you prove where you were last night?
Not all night.
Jesse, I've seen the pictures. His face. I couldn't shoot someone. I don't own a gun. I don't even know how to use one.
You were identified by an eyewitness.
Yes, sir.
Do you think the witness had a prejudice?
I don't think so. No. If you want to know where I was...
Are you a lawyer, Officer Stone?
No, I'm a cop.
Don't try to tell me how to do my job. This interview is over.
The cop takes in the young defendant's helpless gaze. Now outside, Jesse uses his cell phone.
We did not recover the murder weapon.
So no prints. Something doesn't make sense.
What doesn't make sense?
I don't know. I gotta think about it.
He ends the call and continues down the sidewalk. Now a massive red brick mansion stands behind an iron gate. Atop the entryway, brass letters spell the word Tranquility. Just beyond the gate, a large granite stone juts majestically from a wishing pond situated between two well-tended shrub beds. A gazebo stands close by. Jesse arrives at the gatehouse and shows his badge to the guard. The cop pushes the gate open, then swings it shut behind him as he enters. He follows a gray footpath alongside one of the shrubbery beds. The troubled cop pauses between the wishing pond and the gazebo and pulls a handful of change from his pocket. Selecting a penny, he tosses it in. Staring toward the water, Jesse heaves a weary sigh. He turns on the spot to face the gazebo. Stuffing his hands into the pockets of his cargo jacket, he looks pensively at the empty structure. He shifts his melancholy gaze, then gives the gazebo one more glance and heads for the main building. Now a silver lighter ignites. Its flame lights a cigarette in the lips of a man with a silver goatee. The well-dressed smoker faces Jesse.
Tranquility is committed to providing a high standard of care to our patients in a nurturing environment.
Do you normally discharge a client in 2 weeks, Dr. Parkinson?
We don't have clients. We treat patients, Officer...
Jesse.
Well, Officer Jesse, the duration of a patient's stay varies.
How so?
If a patient's addiction is a form of self-medication because of a bigger psychological issue, in some cases, 2 weeks is sufficient, with Of course, intensive outpatient follow-up.
Did Cindy get intensive outpatient follow-up?
Dr. Parkinson takes a drag on his cigarette.
Was Cynthia Van Alden self-medicating?
How do you know Cynthia's duration of treatment was 2 weeks?
She was a friend. Was Cindy self-medicating?
That's between the patient and her doctor.
And her doctor would be?
Her doctor would be me. Why is state homicide interested in a death that the local police have described as a probable suicide?
Suicide's not good for your image.
Addiction is a complex problem.
Do you feel any sense of responsibility? As her doctor.
Well, Cynthia's death is, of course, a horrible tragedy. You haven't answered my question.
That's correct. When she was discharged, was she prescribed drugs?
I can't tell you that. We're not allowed to disclose patient information. There are privacy laws, Officer Jesse.
Except for family.
Even for family. She was 19.
Even if they're paying the bills.
That's not to be considered.
Are prescription drugs used in the treatment of alcohol dependency, Doctor?
They can be. There are tranquilizers and antidepressants that may serve as an interim step in the treatment of alcohol dependency.
With, of course, intensive outpatient follow-up.
Of course.
So you'd consider it?
If one of our doctors felt it was appropriate, it's possible he or she might prescribe medication.
Well, you were her doctor.
That's all I'm required to tell you.
He puts out his cigarette in an ashtray beside his brass nameplate. Jesse stands.
Were you thinking of checking yourself in, Chief Stone?
He pauses near the door.
I commute to Boston. I live in Paradise, small town.
Now at an intimate restaurant table, Jesse shows Sister Mary John a wallet-sized photo of Cindy.
She was at the sanctuary a couple of times recently. She wasn't one of my regular girls, but she did spend some overnights.
You have a good memory.
I do. She was pretty wasted.
Was she drunk?
No, drugs. Maybe painkillers. For sure she was shooting smack. I saw the tracks.
What do you know about a place called Tranquility?
They give families the answers they want to hear. They cost a lot, don't do much good, and can be part of the problem.
This kid went in for alcohol and came out with prescription drugs.
Well, heroin's the main course, but they might have provided the appetizers. Places like Tranquility just substitute addictions. No follow-up, no exit strategy. It's a rehab mill. Starting to rant, that's not part of my job description.
Jesse smiles forgivingly, and she eyes the photo again.
She's dead, isn't she?
Yes.
What was her name?
Cindy Van Alden.
A waiter arrives.
Thank you.
He serves a glass of red wine to Sister Mary John, then sets a steaming cup of coffee in front of Jesse. The nun takes note.
Can I ask you something?
You can.
Is Cindy the reason we're having dinner, Jesse?
Yes.
Was there any other reason?
Yes.
So you think we might have had dinner otherwise?
Yes.
Last time you said you didn't know what to do at dinner with a nun.
How'd I do, sister?
You did just fine.
I figure if I practice, I'll get it right.
She watches him steadily, her delicate features set in a knowing smirk.
I just like you.
He looks into her sparkling ocean blue eyes.
I like you, Jesse.
Now sunlight streams into Jesse's living room, where Reggie lounges in his armchair. He watches his master, who stands in the kitchen pouring a cup of coffee. The troubled cop carries the mug to a counter and takes another down from a shelf. Jesse fills the second cup, then carries both out of the kitchen. Reggie stoically watches him go. Jesse reaches the bedroom, where Thelma reclines on the bed in an oversized gray t-shirt. As he gives her one of the mugs, she cups it in both hands and breathes in the aroma. Jesse sits at the foot of the bed.
Most men and women lead lives of quiet desperation.
That's a quote from someplace.
My desperations are never quiet.
I got hats older than you.
We found a common interest.
Used cars.
He stands.
Sex.
Anyone special?
That I'm having sex with? I'm not seeing anyone at the moment.
I'm divorced.
He holsters his gun.
I knew that. Why are you still carrying a gun?
Peace of mind.
Do you always carry one?
Yes. I was a cop in L.A.
Always a cop?
No. I played baseball before I got hurt.
Were you any good?
I was very good.
What do you know?
Interested.
As he steps away from his bureau, they share a lingering stare. Thelma coyly sips her coffee as he moves past, then looks away.
You over your wife?
Ex-wife.
You over her?
No. You looking for a husband?
No.
Jesse returns to the bureau.
I've got two kids in college.
You married young?
I did.
Two kids in college, it's a lot of money.
Their father can afford it. I raised them. He paid for it. He's always been good that way.
In what way wasn't he good?
Where his penis led, he followed.
Eyeing her through a mirror, Jesse gives a small, understanding nod and smiles.
I enjoyed our dance.
Pressure possibility. The way your hips moved under your dress.
What possibility?
Possibility of seeing you without the intervening dress.
Jesse resumes his seat at the edge of the bed, his expression grim.
I'm not a good basket to put all your eggs in.
I'm not going to fall in love with you. I don't think you'll fall in love with me.
Thelma sets her cup aside.
We can be each other's friend. We can have some nice and complicated sex. I'm going to take a shower.
She leaves the bed.
I wish you could join me.
Jesse starts to speak, then clamps his mouth shut. The image freezes and fades to black.
And neither have I wings to fly. Give me a boat to carry to, and we shall row, my love and I.
You are listening to Video Description on the SAP channel. To return to regular program audio, turn off the SAP feature on your TV or VCR. Somberly dressed townsfolk sit in a small chapel. Wearing a dark tan jacket over his dress shirt and tie, Jesse sits alone in a pew at the back of the church, his lips turned in a rueful frown. His cheek twitches as he rumples his mouth and blinks his stricken eyes. He drops his gaze to his hand clenched in his lap. Opening his palm, he stares down at a penny and remembers a different penny splashing into a wishing pond. In his flashback, Cindy watches the penny tosser from the entrance of the Tranquility Gazebo.
I don't know why people do that. It doesn't do any good.
Jesse sits behind her on the railing. She turns from the entrance and sits on a bench.
So why do you want my picture?
I like you.
Cindy texts on her phone.
Turn that thing off.
What is that about?
It's rude, and I don't like them.
He sits beside her on the bench. She puts her phone away.
They don't work anyway. Garbage disposals are supposed to dispose of your garbage, so why do you have to sort your garbage before you only dispose of some of it? Same thing.
Okay.
Just because you earned back the right to use it doesn't mean you have to.
You're not usual.
People your age are always certain of what's usual.
How would you know that?
I used to be your age. When's the last time you talked to your dad?
Not since he went away.
Fathers are important now that you got your cell phone back. Why don't you call him?
Don't tell me what to do.
I didn't.
Why doesn't he call me?
I asked you first. Why won't you talk to your dad?
Don't get all parental on me, Jesse, okay?
Jesse carefully watches the young woman, who shifts her gaze away, then nervously lowers her eyes.
I'm afraid he won't want to talk to me.
Okay. Maybe your dad's afraid of the same thing.
Cindy sucks in a deep breath and shrugs the corner of her mouth.
I gotta go to group.
She stands and holds out a photo.
Here.
The divorce wasn't your fault.
Jesse takes the photo, stands, and faces her.
I know something about divorce.
Cindy hangs her head. She blinks as tears appear in her eyes, then lifts her gaze back to Jesse. Stepping toward him, she wraps her arms around his waist and presses her cheek to his chest. Jesse gives a surprised look, then folds the petite young woman in a fatherly embrace. He rests his cheek on the top of her head as she clutches his jacket. She releases him and leaves the gazebo. With a tearful look, Jesse takes out Cindy's photo and eyes it. Back in the present, Jesse stares at Cindy's photo. Lifting his gaze, he finds the mourners adjourning. Rose and Suitcase join him, and he hands her the photo.
You can only do what you can do, Jesse.
butler strolls over and gives a nod.
When's your gun permit expire? I noticed you're carrying.
That's good police work, Chief. Retired police officers are entitled to carry. It's federal law.
You were let go.
Sir, if you would care to read the transcripts of the town council meeting, I think that you would find that former Chief Stone was granted early retirement.
How generous. So you're armed at a funeral?
You can assume I'm...
always armed.
Don't finish my sentences.
Sir, I feel the department should formally express its regrets to Mrs. Van Alden.
Cindy did not commit suicide.
It doesn't really matter if it was an accidental overdose or suicide. There's clearly no sign of foul play. Looking under rocks is only going to cause that poor mother further grief. It's just a
horrible tragedy.
Stay out of this, Stone. Luther, shall we?
As Butler leaves, Suitcase leans toward Jesse.
You can only do what you can do.
He gives his friend an earnest look. The former police chief lowers his gaze as Suitcase follows after his new boss. Rose hands back Cindy's photo.
Was Cindy ever busted?
Jesse.
Did you do a criminal background check?
He said it wasn't necessary.
But you did one anyway.
He said for you to stay out of it.
What do you think he meant by that?
That you stay out of it.
I'm going to find out one way or the other.
His lips press into a straight line. Rose clenches her jaw and glances after Butler.
Jesse, Cindy was pretty close to bottom. She was busted 2 months ago on possession of heroin and Oxycontin. And prostitution.
Jesse's lips part in a disconcerted expression. He looks away. Later, at the tavern, he sits at the bar between Captain Healy and Rose.
Joey was only out about 3 hours. His attorney looks stunned.
Guy's got his head up his ass. Sorry, Rose.
So the guy has his head up his ass. And?
Brand new public defender with an oversized ego.
He should have just pled him guilty.
Not sure he did it.
If you want an argument, you're gonna have to change the subject.
How do you know he didn't do it?
I don't. Where they got him now?
They're keeping the county awaiting sentencing.
You said there was an eyewitness.
Doesn't mean it was him.
A lot of white people are afraid of black people. Won't look them in the eye.
What'd you get out of him before the PD shut him up?
He said he was somewhere else but couldn't prove it. If you don't like the answers you're getting, check your premises.
My new boss just walked in.
Butler sits at a table with Hanson and Dr. Parkinson.
You want to put my coat over your head?
How about I put mine over yours?
Don't look too social. Who's the guy doing the finger pointing?
Wealthy local runs a high-end rehab place in Boston.
How do you know that, Jesse?
Small town.
How's everybody doing?
Fine.
Rose?
Maybe later.
I'll have one, Laura.
That's two.
She gives Jesse a pointed look as he sips from his half-full glass. Later, headlights blaze in the dark as his SUV pulls into view. It cruises down a quiet residential street and turns into the driveway of a modest house. Sitting in the passenger seat, Rose unbuckles her belt and peeks out the window at her house.
Looks like my boys are still up. My mom won't say no to them.
How's your new chief?
I don't like him.
You sound like me. I'm gonna get my job back, Ross. Fate won't do this to me.
Jesse, have you ever considered counseling?
You mean like a shrink?
Have you ever considered it?
Only crazy people see shrinks. I'm seeing one.
You're seeing a shrink?
I am.
Is he any good?
I have nothing to compare him to.
What's he like?
He's an ex-cop, so he's unorthodox, which is good for me. Knows a lot about addiction and divorce, which would be good for you.
Rose blinks and averts her eyes. She creases her brow, then returns her gaze to Jesse.
Would he see me?
I'll talk to him.
What are you gonna do, Jesse?
I'm gonna go home and feed Reggie.
Don't be cute.
It's hard for me not to be cute.
Good night, Jesse.
With an amused smile, Rose opens her door and climbs out. As she rounds the back of the SUV and heads up her front steps, Jesse watches attentively through the driver's side window. Rose pauses on the porch and waves, then opens her front door. Jesse shifts in his seat and faces forward, then lowers his thoughtful gaze. His image freezes and fades to black. Now in an office, an attractive woman in her mid-20s works at a reception desk. Jesse strolls up.
Hello.
And you would be?
Jesse.
Do you have a last name?
Stone. And you would be?
Amanda.
Do you have a last name?
No. Do you have an appointment with Mr. Fish?
I do not.
Pursing her lips haughtily, Amanda steps out from behind her desk. Jesse eyes her swaying hips as she confidently strides to a door in the corner. A security keypad guards its entrance. The receptionist turns on her heel and faces Jesse.
Mr. Fish is in.
As Jesse heads over, Amanda punches buttons on the keypad.
You're not going to give me a hard time, Amanda?
You're on the list.
What list is that?
Mr. Fish is in. He's having breakfast.
She sashays back to her desk and Jesse heads inside. Later, a man sets a stool and bucket in the corner of a boxing ring. Beside the ring, a well-dressed waiter pours coffee for Jesse and Gino Fish.
Thank you, Stephen.
I guess I'm on the list.
Amanda does have the names of people I don't mind seeing.
I'm touched. Beautiful woman.
Well, there are certain advantages to having an attractive woman as an assistant.
Such as?
Gino daintily sips his coffee.
Let's just leave it at that, Jesse Stone.
Do you miss Alan?
I don't miss having a psychopath in my outer office, no.
Actually, he was a sociopath.
Well, he's a dead sociopath.
Some say he was hit by that car intentionally.
Can I tell you something, Jesse Stone?
You can.
You're off your game. Your banter isn't up to standard. You seem preoccupied.
You are.
You're not wearing your PPD hat.
That's retired.
As are you. You thinking about coming over to the dark side, Jesse Stone?
Not hardly. I lost a friend.
Would you like some eggs?
She was being treated for an alcohol issue at a place called Tranquility.
Rehab mill.
I've heard it described as that. They graduated her on prescription drugs, and within a year, she was into smack and prostitution. How's that happened, you know?
You're asking me?
I am. You have scruples about prostitution.
So do you.
And you know something about drugs.
Hey, I am just a boxing promoter.
You're a significant contributor to Sister Mary John Shelton.
Now that is private.
Jesse takes out his notepad and scribbles down his number.
You hear things.
I hear a lot of things.
And you know a lot about drugs.
He rips off the page and hands it to Gina.
If we are to remain friends, you'll have to allow me my personal vanities and my double standards. It was nice seeing you, Jesse Stone.
Jesse gives an understanding nod and rises from the table. Gino eyes him closely. Now at Boston State Homicide, Jesse strolls into Healy's office, where he finds his friend sitting at his computer. The captain's brow creases as he types.
Did you change your mind about picking up the check?
Hey, I'm a pensioned retiree.
If you say so.
I don't think he did it.
Jury didn't agree. Why don't you think he did it?
I don't know.
He seemed like a decent kid.
So did Ted Bundy. If you don't like the answers you're getting, check your premises. I think it's right in our face and we can't see it. You proficient on that thing?
Not hardly.
Well, unless you want to call in one of your college boys. Check for unsolved crimes on the same date in the same vicinity about the same time as the killing.
Healy frowns as he pecks at the keyboard with two fingers.
I'm sure one of my highly educated college graduates would have run this.
Are you now?
Healy pulls up a map.
Okay. We got a rape 3 blocks away.
What time is the killing?
11:45. The rapist approached the victim at 11:43.
Well, unless the guy's a two-minute wonder, we got a theory.
We got more than that. We got the rapist's DNA.
You got the perp's DNA?
Hold on a second. You know, give me a minute. I gotta have my fingers catch up to my mind here. I'm checking my premises.
Jesse raises his brow as the computer searches a database.
couldn't match his DNA with anything at the robbery scene. But we did get it.
My sense is it'll match the rapist.
You know, I believe it will. So why didn't you call me with this? Why'd you come in?
I just like you.
Give me the badge. I got a call from Dr. Parkinson at a place called Tranquility, and a call from Rutherford College. They were inquiring into state homicide's investigation into the death of a Cynthia Van Alden.
Good for them.
After Dr. Parkinson suggested that you were impersonating a police officer, I assured him that you were working for state homicide.
Did you also get a call from the Paradise police chief?
I'm not going to tell you that. Give me the badge.
Avoiding Jesse's gaze, Healy folds his hands. Jesse takes the badge from his pocket and puts it on the desk.
When are you going to get your head out of your ass and think?
Do you want to know who she was?
I do not.
Healy places the badge back in its drawer. Later, clouds roll across the stormy sky as rain showers down. A luxury sedan pulls up to the main building of Tranquility. Leaning against a post in the gazebo, Jesse inserts a piece of gum into his mouth and chews thoughtfully. The sedan idles nearby. Dr. Parkinson opens his umbrella as he exits the main building and heads down the steps to the car, where a chauffeur holds a door open for him. The doctor hands the chauffeur his umbrella, then climbs into the back seat. Jesse watches out of the corner of his eye as the chauffeur gets into the vehicle and drives away. Now inside the building, Jesse's backlit silhouette comes into focus as it strides toward us. Later in the main office, a young man in a sweater vest and tie holds a file as he eyes Jesse with an uncertain look.
Are you sure this is police business?
It is.
May I see your badge?
What's your name?
Louis Lipinski.
What do you do here, Louis?
I work for Dr. Parkinson.
You're an intern?
Yes.
Where do you go to school?
Rutherford College.
I'm sure Dr. Parkinson shared with you the fact that I saw him 2 days ago on police business.
He did.
Are you trying to hide something, Louis?
No, sir.
Jesse.
Jesse?
Louis, I'm simply trying to locate a former patient. His name is Val.
We've never had a patient named Val.
How would you know that, Louis?
It's not a common name, sir.
Not a common name, Jesse.
Jesse.
Could Val have been an employee?
Louis takes a deep breath and sits.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, what, Louis?
We're not supposed to talk about Valeri.
You're not supposed to talk about Valeri who, Louis?
Valeri Simonov.
Because?
Because he was let go.
Because?
I believe he falsified his resume. I think that was the reason.
Was there another reason, Louis?
It might have had something to do with the fact that he was busted for drugs.
And prostitution?
Yes. Pimping. Please do not tell Dr. Parkinson about this.
What did Valeri do here, Louis?
He was only an orderly, so that could hardly reflect on Tranquility's mission of providing care and nurturing to our guests who have entrusted us with their destiny.
When was he fired?
Almost 2 months ago.
Do you know he was busted with Cindy Van Alden? She was a former patient.
I do know that. I also know her from Rutherford.
Do you know she's dead?
The young man stares sadly at Jesse, his mouth agape.
Doesn't look good on Tranquility's resume.
No, it doesn't.
You're a good kid, Louis. Is this what you want to do with your life?
No, Jesse.
As Jesse leaves, the young man stares off with a deeply troubled gaze. The image freezes and fades to black. Now Thelma works at her desk. Jesse strolls in.
Afternoon, Thelma.
Afternoon, Jesse.
He heads into Hasty's office. Pausing in her work, Thelma stares after him with a tense gaze. She blinks thoughtfully, then yields a faint smile. At his desk, Hasty scribbles on a yellow pad surrounded by crumpled pages.
May I have the keys?
Nice car.
I need to sell it.
Well, I might consider a purchase. I'm just not quite convinced yet. Maybe if I test drove it for a couple of days. What are you writing?
My stump speech. Your trips to Boston have created concern in some circles.
Hey, I'm working for State Homicide.
There are people in Paradise, powerful people, that would like the Van Alden death forgotten.
Dr. Parkinson calling?
I wouldn't associate with that piece of crap. All I'm saying is you could lose your pension. You could go to jail. It's been 5 days, and knowing you, I'm sure you've broken some laws by now.
I'd rather regret the things I've done than the things I haven't done.
Hasty regards him warmly, then cocks his head.
2 days.
Jesse gets to his feet and heads for the door.
I'm very fond of you, Jesse.
He slows briefly, then leaves. Scribbling on his pad, Hasty smiles to himself. Now under a cloudy sky, Jesse's loner SUV arrives at a shipping yard stocked with metal crates the size of big rig trailers. A hauling tractor passes by as the rugged vehicle comes to a stop on the gravel. Jesse climbs out, his simple black cap shading his eyes from the bright sunlight. He scans his surroundings with a keen gaze, then leaves the SUV. Now we descend into a labyrinth of shipping crates stacked 3 or 4 high. Gino Fish steps into view, one hand shoved into his overcoat pocket as he smokes a cigar. Jesse comes up behind him with a takeout cup of coffee in his hand. His SUV sits parked several yards back. Lowering his cigar, Gino exhales a cloud of smoke that dissipates in the wind.
Morning.
I find a certain poetic symmetry to having you meet me. You gave me the heads up about Alan.
So speaking symmetrically, you have something to give me.
I do. 2 tickets to the fight Saturday night at the Garden.
He holds them out. Stepping closer, Jesse accepts them.
Okay.
Oh, and there was one additional item. Moscow Nights. Ring a bell?
No.
Outcall Massage. The missing part of your puzzle is Valery Simonov. Wetback Pimp.
You don't like this guy.
What's not to dislike? These Russians, they have no code. I will bow to no man that's not a code.
Russian mob?
No, freelance wannabe. He recruits his girls by working at rehab clinics. He's a predator. He knows their profiles. He romances them when they're their most vulnerable. What happened to your friend?
She's dead. Overdosed on heroin. Tranquility put her on antidepressants, pronounced her cured, and forgot about her. So did I.
Not your fault.
When she stopped calling, I could have found her.
I think I know you, Jesse Stone.
Meaning?
Meaning, you will have to do something about your friend. These Russians are bad guys. You need to be careful.
The ugly truth of it, Gino, is it doesn't matter a whole hell of a lot to me.
It was nice talking to you, Jesse Stone.
Gino strides off alongside a shipping container. Jesse purses his lips. Nighttime. A boat glides through a harbor. A man strides out of a waterfront building and saunters down the front steps. Casually scanning his surroundings, he strolls to an older model burgundy sedan and climbs behind the wheel. The sedan drives off beside the harbor. Behind it, another car's side view mirror shows a reflection of Jesse's stern face as he watches it go. Now a young blonde woman in torn fishnets and a ragged denim miniskirt paces uneasily outside a ritzy hotel. The burgundy sedan pulls into the carport and parks. Its driver climbs out, holding a cigarette with his lips. Exhaling a cloud of smoke, the hawk-faced man swaggers over to the young woman. She murmurs a few words and he nods, then flicks his cigarette away. He strides back toward the driver's side door as the young woman gets in the front passenger seat. The sedan pulls out of the hotel carport and turns onto the road. Jesse watches from his car across the street. He glances blankly at his coffee cup, then takes a sip. Staring off thoughtfully, he smacks his lips. Now in the tavern, a thin stream of scotch douses a few cubes of ice in a glass tumbler. At the bar, Jesse scowls and flips through the pages of his notepad. The slender young bartender sets the scotch beside his arm.
Thanks, Mom.
That's one.
She turns away from him, eyeing his reflection on a mirrored back wall. The former cop dials his cell phone. He puts it to his ear.
Welcome to Moscow Night, offering the complete massage experience in the privacy of your hotel room. Would you like to speak to one of our beautiful Russian therapists?
Jesse, I'm sorry.
His intense gaze drifts.
You're my best friend. I need to talk. I tried to call you, but your phone is disconnected. I'm coming back to paradise.
His brow knit, Jesse squeezes his eyes shut. Later, he sleeps. Warm light and faint shadows flutter across his rugged features. Jesse flinches, blinking his eyes open. He looks around quizzically and winces, then braces himself with one arm and lifts his head. Wearing his shirt and suit coat from the night before, he rolls onto his side on top of his comforter and stares across the room. Reggie lies on his plaid dog bed, his head upright and his dark eyes gazing sadly at his master.
What are you looking at?
Closing his eyes, Jesse shoves himself onto his back. Reggie continues to stare. Later, Jesse strides into the Boston State Homicide Office, clutching a cup of coffee. Healy is talking to a young man at a desk.
You called me?
The former police chief heads into his friend's office. Healy trails after him, carrying a file.
The DNA's a match.
Your perp's not the perp.
But he is a rapist.
So the judge declares a mistrial and you arrest him for the rape?
That's correct.
I'd like to be a fly on the wall for that one. You could have told me this on the phone.
Healy takes a seat.
You close to Cynthia Van Alden?
I was.
Got any evidence of foul play?
I do not.
If you get anything, I'll go after it.
Jesse strides toward the door.
Don't do this on your own. Jesse.
He halts and faces his friend, who scratches his ear.
Thanks for this.
Pursing his lips, the former chief offers a nod and leaves. Now the hawk-faced Valeri and the young blonde march across the lobby of a luxury hotel. The blonde wears the same ragged denim miniskirt. Later, Jesse opens a hotel room door and finds the pair outside.
You and Mr. Stone.
Jesse, come in. Please.
They brush past him and file inside. Jesse hangs a please do not disturb sign on the door. Entering a living room, the blonde surveys the posh suite. Jesse faces her.
Dobry dzień.
You speak Russian?
I was talking to her. What's your name?
Svetlana.
Is she Russian or not? I'm paying for a Russian.
No. She's not Russian, but she's young and beautiful, is she not?
Jesse studies the young woman's heavily made-up face.
Are you a cop?
Why would you ask?
If I ask, you have to tell me. Otherwise, it's entrapment.
No, I'm not a cop.
Good. You, of course, have to pay in advance. Then I will leave.
You don't have to stay and watch.
After you pay, I will leave.
Actually, I was a cop. Small town police chief, but I got into a little trouble and I had to retire early.
He kicks Valeri in the crotch. Clutching himself, the pimp crumbles to his knees. Jesse knocks him out with the butt of his gun. He takes the blonde girl's hand and tows her to the door, then faces her urgently.
What's your real name?
Emily.
Your family, Emily?
Yes.
If you need to talk to someone, call me.
Jesse hands her his card and opens the door.
Go home.
He ushers her into the hallway, and she dashes off, vanishing around a corner. Jesse gazes after her with a frown.
Please go on, Emily.
He shuts the door. Later, Valeri sits in a chair in the center of the suite, wearing only his briefs. Duct tape binds his arms and legs to the chair, and Russian tattoos cover his arms and torso. Another piece of duct tape glues his mouth shut. Jesse rips it off. Valeri stifles a cringe, and Jesse examines the tape.
You're a tough guy.
I'm tough enough.
He balls it up and throws it away.
Cindy Van Alden.
Horrible tragedy. I didn't kill her.
You might as well have. I bow to no man. What's that about? If your friends could see you now.
Jesse fixes himself a drink.
You prey on kids.
As he takes a sip, Valeri eyeballs him coolly.
You're thinking about shooting me.
I am.
You can't kill me.
Why can't I kill you?
The cartel has your name.
Actually, I registered under an assumed name. Valeri Simonov. I paid cash.
Wearing leather gloves, Jesse takes another drink, then sets it aside and draws his gun.
You need to retire, Valeri.
It's not in my plan.
Okay.
Jesse holds a pillow over the gun.
So shoot me.
I've been thinking about that.
He glances at it.
Oh, this? Just kidding.
He tosses the pillow down. The pimp watches him stiffly as he takes a seat.
Do you hunt, Valeri?
No, I think it's cruel.
Well, here's what I was thinking. When you shoot a big animal like a deer or an elk with a high-powered rifle, you can shoot him right through the heart and he still might run off, sometimes for quite a distance. The animal's already dead. He just doesn't know it yet. It's a good thing animals can't think. Now people can think. I'm gonna haunt you, Valeri. You won't know when it's gonna happen, but when it does, you'll have time to think.
Jesse stands and ambles away, leaving the pimp taped to the chair.
You need to consider retirement, Valeri. I'm enjoying the hell out of it.
Jesse puts on his coat.
Oh, and when you work your way out of all that, one piece of advice for your own good, stay away from the minibar.
He strolls out. As Valeri fumes, his image freezes and fades to black. In the interrogation room.
The judge declared a mistrial.
How'd you do it?
Oh, I just stayed at it.
You saved my life.
Oh. They said they'd make a formal announcement later on today.
Then I can get out of here.
I don't know why not.
A detective enters.
Giles Morris?
Am I free to go?
You're under arrest for rape and assault perpetrated on Mrs. Jane Francis on February 4th.
He handcuffs Charles.
You have the right to remain silent and refuse to answer questions. Do you understand?
He does.
Anything you say may be used against you in a court of law. Do you understand?
He does.
In an observation room.
You have the right to consult an attorney before speaking to the police.
Crackerjack. I got good and plenty.
If you decide to answer questions now without a lawyer present.
Thanks for this.
You have the right to stop questioning at any time until you talk to a lawyer. Do you understand what I've read?
Yes, he understands.
Now at Paradise Cove, Reggie bounds onto the beach, then splashes into the water. Jesse looks on from the pavilion. Soaking wet, the retriever wags his tail and glances around, his tongue hanging out contentedly. Jesse stares soberly at his dog.
I feel he has issues, Jesse.
Suitcase ambles into the gazebo in street clothes.
We both do. We took off early.
I did.
He sits on the picnic table.
Where's your cruiser?
At the station.
What you need to talk about?
Jesse sits beside him.
Did Cindy commit suicide?
I don't think so.
Well, we don't know.
No, we don't.
You won't let me go after it, Jesse.
I would expect no less of him.
I want an answer. I know you want an answer.
I may not find one.
I see it as my job not to look the other way.
You quit, didn't you?
Numbness of the heart.
You do this for me?
For myself.
You sure about that?
I don't belong there anymore. I feel it in myself.
Does Rose know?
She understands. Said she can't afford not to stay.
You're a good cop, Soup. You can hang your hat on that.
You going after Tranquility?
No, they didn't help her, but they didn't kill her.
My sense is you're going after somebody, Jesse. I want to help.
I'm not after anybody, Suitcase.
Nighttime. In his living room, Jesse and Reggie watch Mr. Smith goes to Washington.
There's no place out there for graft, or greed, or lies, or compromise with human liberties. And that, if that's what the grown-ups have done with this world that was given to them, then we better get those boys' camps started fast and see what the kids can do. and it's not too late. Because this country is bigger than the Taylors, or you, or me, or anything else. Great principles don't get lost once they come to light. They're right here. You just have to see them again.
Jesse sips a scotch. Now in the reception area of Gino Fish's office, Amanda types at her desk. A burly man in a long coat saunters toward her down a shadowy industrial hallway. He wears a beard, and his long gray hair hangs in a ponytail down his back. Amanda looks up and locks eyes with the imposing thug, then scoots away from her desk and hurries toward the door. She types the code onto the keypad, and the burly man heads through. In the gym, several boxers practice in the two rings. Our view glides over the sparring fighters to reveal Gino's office area tucked between the rings. A half dozen oriental rugs carpet the space, which includes a leather sofa and armchair as well as a conference table. Gino sits thoughtfully at his desk, smoking a thick cigar and holding a golden lighter. Looking up, he watches the burly man stride toward him across the rugs. The thug bends and whispers in his ear. The crime lord blinks, shifting uneasily as the burly man heads out. Gino toys with his lighter, repeatedly lighting it and snapping it shut. Back at Jesse's house.
Stop, Jeff, stop!
The TV shows Jimmy Stewart cringing tearfully, his hair damp and his face glistening with sweat. He bows his head and hunches weakly, then searches his notes. Nearby, a group of young boys watch him soberly. One boy's chin quivers. In Jesse's living room, light from the TV flickers on Reggie's dark, doleful eyes. On screen, Jimmy Stewart lifts his gaze, and a disheveled, middle-aged man smiles at him. Jesse frowns at the screen, furrowing his brow. Jimmy Stewart blinks and looks over his shoulder at a white-haired man who drops his gaze.
I guess this is just another lost cause, Mr. Payne.
Jesse's eyes drift thoughtfully.
All you people don't know about lost causes. Mr. Payne does.
Behind him, his cell phone sits on the kitchen counter.
He said once they were the only causes worth fighting for.
With Gino.
This is Jesse. Leave a message.
The crime lord speaks into his cell.
He knows who you are.
He ends the call and anxiously rubs his knuckles under his nose.
I was stupid, Gino.
He tosses the phone down. Later, Jesse's TV flickers with static. Reggie lies asleep, his head draped over the arm of his leather chair onto the end table. Jesse sleeps in his chair, his chest rising and falling steadily. His eyes flutter and he awakens. The former police chief lifts his head and twitches his brow, then drowsily looks around. He musters a frown and scoots forward in his chair, then slouches and rests his head in his hands. Looking up, he collects an empty glass, stands, and hobbles off. A half-drunk bottle of scotch stands on the counter beside his cell phone and handgun. Jesse sets down his glass and picks up the bottle, then pauses, staring at it. He heaves a sigh. Reggie watches, propping his snout on the end table. Jesse glances at the dog, then lets his gaze dart pensively. He rumples his lips. Now a view of the house from a distance shows Jesse's porch light turning off. More lights glowing in two windows shut off as well. Our view sweeps across the dimly lit landscape, which lies silhouetted against the dark blue sky. The pale wooden bridge juts out into the shadows. Behind a car window, a hand ignites a lighter. It lights a cigarette tucked between a man's lips. Lowering the lighter, he takes out the cigarette and exhales a stream of smoke. He gazes out through the windshield at Jesse's house across the inlet. Later, smoky clouds drift over the full moon. A view through night vision goggles casts the area in a green glow as the prowler crosses the bridge. Later, the stalker sidles past a bush in front of Jesse's house. A reflection of his goggles gleams on a window. At the front door, his gloved hands ready a submachine gun. Using a suction cup, he attaches a compass-like device to a pane of glass in the windowed door. A lever locks it in place, and the device guides his hand as he maneuvers a glass cutter around the suction cup in a circle. The prowler glances inside through another pane and surveys the home's shadowy interior. Dropping his gaze back to his glass-cutting device, he yanks back on it and neatly pulls a perfect circle of glass out of the pane. The intruder reaches inside through the hole, unlocks the door, and slowly pushes it open. Creeping into the hallway, he finds several coats hanging on hooks, then shifts his gaze. More coats dangle from a coat rack, along with Jesse's PPD baseball cap. The intruder stalks toward the living room, then halts and looks down to find several short steps. He probes the first one with his toe. He carefully mounts the steps and treads forward. Halting again at the kitchen counter, he notices Jesse's scotch, cell phone, and handgun. The intruder looks around, his night vision goggles covering his entire face like a gas mask. As he sweeps his gaze across the living room, the bright white circle of a flashlight turns on behind him.
Don't turn around, Larry.
The masked pimp whirls around and fires his machine gun. Muzzle flashes illuminate Jesse calmly firing a shotgun. Valeri's body convulses. He falls back and sits on the floor. Jesse plugs him in the shoulder, and Valeri collapses onto his back. The former police chief keeps his weapon trained on the intruder, then extinguishes his flashlight. Turning on a lamp, he strides toward the fallen assassin. Blood pools on the floor beneath him. Jesse takes a seat with his shotgun across his lap, then sets it down and leans it against his leather armchair. He rubs his hands and stares down at Valeri. Jesse shifts his gaze.
I don't think you're gonna make it.
The assassin convulses, then falls still. Jesse fixes his gaze on the man and frowns thoughtfully. Reaching down, he lifts the protruding goggles on Valeri's mask. They hinge upward, revealing the assassin's wide, unblinking eyes between the bars strapping the mask to his face. Jesse furrows his brow, purses his goateed mouth, and stares off. Now he opens a closet. Reggie sits forlornly inside, staring up at his master with his chocolatey eyes. Jesse locks gazes with the dog. Daytime. Outside, wearing sunglasses and his plain black ball cap, Jesse hikes along the rocky coastline. Reggie trots at his side, then bounds down to the water's edge and splashes in. Jesse strolls onto a large sloped boulder and stares out at the sea. He checks his watch, then digs his cell phone out of his jacket pocket. He puts it to his ear.
Good morning, Paradise Police Department.
I'd like to report a shooting.
Jesse's calm frown freezes, then fades to black.